Grand jury of Douglas County in regard to Zachary Berryhill. Mr. O'Brien, good morning to you. Let's give everybody a second to get in and out of the courtroom.
Absolutely.
I should note that Justice Miller Lerman is recused from this matter also. And Mr. O'Brien, you may proceed.
Good morning, Your Mr. Chief Justice, members of the Supreme Court. My name is Corey O'Brien. May it please the court. I am the appointed special prosecutor that presided over the grand jury in custody death of Zachary Berryhill. Today I'm joined by third year law clerk, senior certified law clerk Mariah Hatfield. The reason I brought this appeal was essentially threefold. We had two new statutes that were created in 2016 that were a little unclear. Until there was greater clarity on those, I felt it important to protect the integrity of the record of the two individuals that were indicted as a result of the grand jury. And then finally, if necessary, to provoke legislative change to reflect what I argue in my brief was the stated legislative intent of 29-1407.01-2B. As a preliminary matter, I would draw your attention to my brief about appellate jurisdiction on this case and the arguments I espouse in the brief as why I believe that appellate jurisdiction is proper in this matter.
What's your best argument?
I think the best argument, and I tend to agree with appellee, that an in-custody grand jury is much akin to a special proceeding in which there is a substantial interest at play, similar to certain juvenile court proceedings. But I think, as I espouse in my brief, I list any number of the three under 25-1902 that I think that it fits under. My other argument would be is there have been at least three other cases of grand juries brought before this court before where the issues of jurisdiction were not found lacking in any of those three cases.
Were they even addressed in those cases?
They were not addressed at all.
Just kind of jump right into the issue.
They kind of addressed the issue. Right, correct.
Is the special proceeding that you identify the grand jury process in totality or the specific statute allowing for the transcript being made available for public
review? I identify it as the grand jury process in totality. So,
what's the substantial right here?
The substantial right, I think, would be transparency, public, the dissemination of public information. It can both negatively and positively affect a particular case. It can affect the rights of the defendant. It can affect the rights of the special prosecutor going forward. It can affect the rights to a fair and impartial trial by jury, depending on the dissemination of certain information.
Isn't the trial going on right now?
The trial is going on right now.
Does it, your briefing suggests lots of possible scenarios, ways that the information could impede or affect the trial. What do we know about whether any of that has happened?
I can tell you that jury selection was laborious because of the extensive media coverage. There was media coverage before the dissemination of the records.
Have the records been disseminated?
They are available. As I understand it, by talking to the media that are covering this case, they were unaware that they were unavailable. And so that perhaps mitigated some of the consequences I talk about in my brief.
I'm sorry, I misunderstood. They are available?
They are currently available. According to the clerk's office, they are available for the media.
Is this case moot?
Is this case moot?
Yes.
No, because I think that they should not be made available. And the other reason why it's not moot is that there is a second defendant that is currently awaiting trial. And so his rights are still impacted, in my opinion. In terms of my substantive...
That returns me to Justice Funk's question.
Yes.
What's the state's substantial right that's being protected or that's been harmed? I mean, you talked about a potential defendant's.
Right.
Right, but he's not the one standing in front of us.
I get that. My substantial interest is that I produced over 800 exhibits into evidence in this particular case, some of which are very revealing of my case. And while the defendant will have discovery of that, it gives the jury an opportunity, my potential jury, the opportunity to review those before they've even come to court, and I may not even be aware of it. And they may already form opinions about some of the evidence that I presented in that case. And so that's...
So it's the state's own fair trial right?
I would say it's both. I think, but yes, my
but
ability
you, but
to...
But you made a statement that basically all of this is disclosable, must be disclosed to the defendant anyway.
Correct. And my fear is that, for instance, I have videos of the actual event that occurred there. And if that evidence is potentially out there, available on the internet for any potential juror to see, that could impact my ability to receive a fair trial as well as the defendant's.
But isn't that something you can cover in voir dire? And that is true of many, many criminal cases, many of which have more notoriety than this one.
It is true. But the fact of the matter is 99.9% of the state's case is publicly available. That's not the case in most trials, where the public can go and start looking at all my evidence and prejudge all the evidence that I have before the case is actually litigated.
There's also an argument about the 210 witnesses that were called to testify. The grand jury transcripts were released. Those jurors may be unwilling to come forward in future grand juries. I mean, that's part of the argument of the secrecy of grand juries, isn't it?
And that's another concern of mine, and I appreciate you bringing that up, is many of the statements that were made by the witnesses that I've already called or may call at trial, their statements were produced before the grand jury, videotaped statements, transcribed statements. And so the fact that those are out there would potentially prevent future witnesses from coming forward, as well as my witnesses coming forward to testify at trial.
Isn't that a policy decision for the legislature?
It is a policy decision for the legislature, Mr. Chief Justice. What I see in this statute is that I don't know that they recognized that a true bill returned in a grand jury required under 29-1401-4 was a common occurrence. We know that it's not.
When you say they, are you referring to the legislature?
I am referring to the legislature. And I don't think that they ever anticipated that the release of the transcript and the exhibits would take place in the process of conducting an indictment or when there's a true bill returned.
Is this statute ambiguous? I mean, does 29-1407.01 sub 2b, does that say anything other than what it says? Can it be interpreted any other way?
I would agree that it, on its face, it is not ambiguous, but if you consider it in paramateria with other statutes, then I do believe that there is a conflict.
So then we would go to the legislative intent and legislative history and look at those issues.
Right, and I cite out the conflict in my brief that I believe exists.
Why is there a conflict, though?
I'm sorry. The reason why I believe there's a conflict is because they use redundant language in both 29-1406 and then 29-1407.012b. If the intent was to make it publicly available in every case, whether it be no true bill or a true bill return, then why would they have to repeat it again in 29-1406? Why didn't they just say, in addition to the transcript and exhibits as required, and instead they put it in there a second time, which to me indicates that 1407.01 was a general statute and 1406 was the specific statute describing the process by which they have to prepare and then file the transcript and the exhibits.
Are all of the sections that you're talking about now the ones that were specifically amended by LB 1000 in 2016?
So, and I think that that was significant that the court should have considered that, the district court should have considered that, is that 29-1406G and then 29-1407.012B were both part of the same bill that was amended in 2016. And so that's again why I think they failed to recognize that there might be a situation with a true bill, and what do we do in that situation?
This 29-1407.012B, does that have a timing element when that transcript disclosure has to occur?
It doesn't say so. And again, I guess it's left to the discretion of the court. We asked the court in our particular case to not release the transcript until our trial was over. They refused that request.
Let's say hypothetically this court decides to find that 1407.012B requires immediate disclosure of that transcript. Would the state or the defendant, either one, have the option of asking for a protective order from the trial court to have that not disclosed?
We had that option. We used that option. We failed in that option. Both the defendant and the state went to the trial court prior to this trial that's going on right now. We asked for a protective order not to release that information until after that trial was concluded.
Would that be under the court's discretion, though, to either grant it or not to grant it?
Yes, it was under the court's discretion, and they exercised that discretion.
So the statute doesn't preclude a protective order. The statute says you have to release a transcript. If you come and say there's a substantial reason not to do that, a protective order should be entered. That's still an avenue that could be used by the defendant or the state.
It doesn't prevent that, but I think that the district court felt reluctant to enter a protective order since the statute doesn't specifically provide that a protective order could be used to stop the dissemination of the exhibits and the transcript.
Would there be a timing issue in that situation between the point of indictment and the filing of the case to get that protective order request to the trial court for the defendant or the state?
Potentially, because, I mean, realistically, no, because it's going to take some time for the transcript to be prepared and filed. So I don't know that there's a timing issue that would prevent us from going to the trial court and doing that. I think in the interim, we could go to the original grand jury court and ask them, as we did in this case, to prevent its dissemination. But again, it's not necessarily authorized under the statute. Unless this court has any questions for me.
Did you seek a protective order from both the presiding judge and the judge presiding over the criminal trial?
I know that I did from the trial court. I'm not sure that I
which
did.
Which trial court?
I'm sorry, the trial court that was presiding over the Payne prosecution.
Thank you.
I did not do it from the grand jury court. Thank you. I'd ask you to reverse and remand with directions to look at and consider the legislative history. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you very much. Mr. Cox.
Mr. Fisher, actually.
Mr. Fisher, good morning to you.
Good morning. May it please the court.
And counsel,
my name is Dan Fisher. I'm with the Coley Jessen Law Firm. I am joined by my law partner, Mike Cox, at counsel table. We have the privilege of representing the Omaha World Herald and KETV Channel 7, which has collectively been referred to as the media in this case. First off, in addressing some of the questions that the court has, it is also our understanding that the protective order issue was only made to the trial court that was presiding over the criminal cases that resulted from the two indictments that were handed down. There was not a protective order sought in the special or in the grand jury proceeding before the Judge Doherty, who presided over that, because Judge Durr has.
Do you agree that that option is available to whomever might want it?
I don't think that the statute forbids the request. I think under Nebraska law, it could be problematic given the statute to obtain one. And I say that for this reason, as we know from this court's teachings in Aksamit and Everston, that once you have a public policy of public records, of open disclosure to records, then there is an automatic application of you have to read the access to the records, the provision of the records, broadly. and liberally, and you have to read any restrictions narrowly. And I think that's going to make it difficult to obtain a protective order when the legislature has made the purposeful decision to make these records public.
So are you telling us that if this case had come in up to us in a different posture, and that Mr. O'Brien had asked grand jury judge, for example, for some kind of protective order, and the grand jury judge had allowed it, would you be in front of us arguing that that simply is not allowed?
Yes, I believe that we would be asserting that the protective order, without particular evidence to go to the harms that they speculate about, would be difficult to obtain under Nebraska law, under the precedent that we have to read the access to the records liberally and restrictions narrowly.
Would your argument be that the legislature would have to specifically have said in this legislation that you state, or you, whomever, can get a protective order of some kind?
Yes, I do think that given the purposeful decision of the legislature to change the statute for the very specific reasons it does, to ask the court to overrule that then goes against some of the court's precedent that the division of powers as to who makes the decision about what are the valid reasons to change a statute and why. So I do think that there would be a battle on that issue, and certainly the legislature could help with that by being more express in the statute as to whether the protective order is available. Now, obviously, the court has the option to consider a protective order. I think it would be difficult under related precedent to obtain one in this case when the legislature has been so clear about what its intent is.
Is there authority outside of these particular statutes that authorize the trial court to impose a protective order?
I think generally,
could that be relied upon?
I do think that, generally speaking, the court has the discretion to enter protective orders on matters that the court views may be appropriate. But again, I think that's going to involve a balancing between generalized statutes like that and the more specific statute you have here that expressly says these records are to be made public. And please keep in mind, when we're talking about a protective order, we're talking about protecting from harms. That requires the special prosecutor to come forward with actual evidence that some harm is going to occur. And there is none of that in this record, for sure. There's only been speculation as to what could potentially occur. In fact, I think
that... Does your argument change if it's been brought by the defendant as opposed to the state?
I don't believe it does, for the reason that, again, the defendant is going to be under the same obligation the state would be, which is to present actual evidence of realized harm. And again, most defendants who bring these types of arguments are actually deferred to the first and best protection for these sorts of harms, which is verdire. I mean, that's where the defendants that make these arguments in individual cases are referred to.
Has the world changed today with the internet? There's been some reference that there's a video of what happened in this case. And if that video is viral, if it's on the internet, has that changed the world so that jurors, for example, are more likely to be tainted now than they would have been 50 years ago when only a newspaper was involved?
I do believe the answer to that is no, for two reasons, a general and a specific reason. First, which is the general reason, which is, again, we go back to any potential impact out there can be tested by verdire. In fact, this court has instructed that verdire is the best way to challenge that. Secondly, the specific reason is in this case, the trial court presiding over the grand jury, so Judge Doherty, his order said that the media was not allowed to copy any of the records. They could only view the records. So in this case, there isn't a risk of the video getting out there because the media couldn't take the video out of the review room at the courthouse. So that's not a concern here.
Couldn't they video it while they're watching it?
Not according to the judge's order, no. So not if they comply with the judge's order. Now, the statute didn't put those sorts of limitations on the review, but the trial court did in this case.
And you're not appealing that issue.
We did not assign that as an error, no.
What, fundamentally, what standing does the World Herald or television station have to even be in this proceeding?
Sure.
What authority did you have to file your motions and argue and brief? And if you offered evidence, what evidence you offered?
Sure. So this court has taught us that standing is some sort of interest, stake, right, title interest in the subject matter of the controversy. As soon as this statute was passed, the public at large, including the media, have the right to ask for these records. In this case, the media was two members of the public, the Omaha World Herald on KETV, that came forward and asked for the records.
Would any member of the public have had standing?
Yes, sir.
Anybody on the street?
Yes, sir. According to this statute, since these records are shall be made, mandatory language, shall be made accessible for public review, any member of the public had the right to come forward and ask for the records.
Is that in our record that you requested the records?
Yes, sir. There's a motion by the World Herald in the transcript, by the media, in the transcript. It was filed, I think, January 29th of this year, maybe the 26th or 29th, that asked for the records to be unsealed.
Is a corporation a person for the purposes of standing?
For the purpose of standing, yes. Corporations have problems when the statute talks about citizenship, but when we talk about a person, a corporation under the law is a fictitious person. So yes, there is authority to support the proposition that a corporation is a person.
The only documentation that we have in our transcript is the order from the district court that presided over the grand jury January 9th, allowing or making public the transcript. And then we have the motions from the state to amend that order. We have defendant Scotty Payne making a motion for protective order. And then we have the newspaper and the World Herald becoming involved, the television becoming involved at that hearing.
If the motion is not in the transcript, because as you recall, there were some portions of the transcript that we didn't have access to by order of the court.
Not this portion.
It shouldn't have been that portion, agreed. There is also reference to that very motion in the Bill of Exceptions. It's on page 24, lines 10 to 24, where the trial court indicates that at the February hearing where we were all talking about this, it was intending to go forward on the press's motion for access to the records at the same time in ruling on the special prosecutor's motion to alter or amend the court's prior order saying it was going to release the record. So that is at least in the record in that way that the trial court recognized that motion was pending and it intended to go forward with that motion, page 24.
What's your best argument to appellate jurisdiction based on final order?
I think this court changed the analysis when we got the Fidler decision last week because it certainly gave us further teachings on what a substantial right is and how to analyze that. And I think that's now a problem for the special prosecutor. Hey, don't get me wrong, I would love to be able to argue that it is not a special or not a final order because that takes this back down to the trial court, allows release of the records, and would prevent one of the things that I would be concerned about, which is what I would term an appellate abuse here. Because every special prosecutor going forward in these cases would see a method to get exactly what they want procedurally, even if the statute says it needs to be made public, by simply filing an appeal. Because then what will happen there is likely what has happened here, which is that exactly what they wanted, which is that the record didn't get released until the criminal trials went forward, which is not what the statute suggests. It's not a limitation. May I have leave? I'm out of time.
You may finish.
To respond?
Yes.
So, I would like to be able to say that it's not a final order for that reason. I think it would prevent that abuse. And I think the Fidler case does suggest that there's some problems now with the analysis of what is the substantial right and that the prosecutor now can't rely on speculation about what could happen in future cases. And you have to ask yourself, well, what's a future case here? Does it include, for example, the cases that are going to go for the criminal cases that move forward off the indictments that were handed down? Or does it only include, or also include, all future cases in these types of instances? And special prosecutors argued both. So I think from a final order standpoint, the Fidler case makes the analysis more difficult that it's a final order. I do think that there's at least two things that suggest there's a final order. One is I do think that the grand jury proceedings do seem to be a special proceeding and meet that requirement, but that requires the substantial right affect that Fidler might change. But also, this court has had three cases in front of it. You are correct that they did not address the jurisdictional issue, but they at least suggest that this court has entertained these types of issues coming out of a grand jury proceeding. And so that's probably the best evidence. That may not be enough, particularly given Fidler, but before Fidler, it seemed like it was a better argument than it is today. Unless there's further questions. Yes, sir.
29-1407.012B, do you agree there is no timing aspect to that when that disclosure is supposed to occur of the transcript?
I agree there's no express timing in the statute. What I do think is practical and expected from that is that, you know, as we know, a grand jury proceeding is essentially an initiating process, and it moves, it either investigates and determines that there is nothing to go forward, or it determines by handing out indictments there'll be some criminal cases going forward. But in either of those cases, that instance where the grand jury comes to a conclusion, the grand jury proceeding is over, and I think some reasonable time for the transcript to be prepared after that point is what would be reasonably expected from the statute, but I would acknowledge it's not expressed in the statute.
Could also be interpreted to be at the conclusion of that matter, which could be the end of a criminal trial that follows that?
I would have trouble accepting that proposition because I would go back to the teachings of this court that, again, this is a statute that says now these records are made available to the public. So restrictions on that availability need to be construed narrowly. And I'm not sure making the argument that we could wait until the end of a separate criminal case that arises from that is construing such a restriction narrowly. Unless there's any other questions from the court, the media would respectfully ask that the trial court's, at least Judge Doherty's order be affirmed and that the records be released. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. Do we have time for rebuttal? There is no time for rebuttal.